Good afternoon. We're going to go ahead and open up the Senate Judiciary Committee. We have two bills that for a public hearing, possible work sessions. I'm going to take them out of order in the sense that I'll take the second one first, which is House Bill 4146A. Open up a public hearing on that. And Representative Smith, I understand you're here to give testimony. Please come forward. And then Mara, you're also here. Why don't you come on up? And is there going to be anyone else who want to give testimony on House Bill 4146A? Not seeing one. It looks like we got our field. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Jefferson Smith, representing District 47 in the State House. This is a small but we think important bill coming over with unanimous vote from the House. I hope you won't hold that against the bill. The child sex trafficking is a growing problem in our state. It is notoriously hard to track directly, but what we think we know is that the I-5 corridor is a trafficking pipeline, that gangs are increasingly involved in forcing young girls into prostitution. With elevated penalties for drugs, child prostitution can offer a more lucrative risk-reward calculus. I want to thank the people in this committee, in fact, I believe every member here from the committee, for your support of the Human Trafficking Hotline Bill in 2009. And this year, the Oregon Center for Christian Values, Commissioner Diane McKeel, and a number of other advocates brought a concept forward. There's a group that's working on an ongoing project to revise our juvenile statutes. So there's just one small change that felt warranted attention this year. In Oregon, we recognize that juveniles can't consent to sexual contact, and local jurisdictions have almost all stopped charging children with prostitution. But this is a recent change, so there's some young adults whose re-entry into society is made more difficult by a prostitution charge when they were a child sex trafficking victim. Our bill will allow a judge to expunge a prostitution adjudication once the victim turns 18. The expungement will cover only the prostitution adjudication and not other crimes that might have occurred while the victim was being trafficked. We know that victims often face significant challenges recovering from trafficking. We hope that Oregon will join Illinois in creating a process to expunge adjudications and ease reentry into society. Thanks for taking the time and hearing the bill.
All right, thank you. And Representative, do you have time to hear the other testimony?
Absolutely.
Mara?
Chair Posonsky, members of the committee, my name is Maura Roach, and I'm testifying on behalf of Youth Rights and Justice. Youth Rights and Justice has represented over 50,000 youth and children in the juvenile court system since 1975, and I'm testifying on behalf of one of our staff attorneys, Lynn Haxton, who has worked with a number of these young women and also participated in two different interim work groups to bring the bills that have come before you in 2011 and now to this committee and through the legislative process. We support House Bill 4146 and believe it is the next step in drawing a clear distinction between the young victims of sex trafficking and the adults who create the demand and who profit from sex trafficking. We believe this bill allows expungement of the juvenile record for an adjudication under the prostitution statute immediately upon the young person turning 18 years of age. Given that persons who have juvenile court records under the prostitution statute would not now be charged today, it is both fair and just to provide a clean slate to youth prosecuted under old practices so they can move forward with their lives. Youth Rights and Justice fully supports this bill because it will give victims of sex trafficking the opportunity to pursue a better life with greater opportunities. We urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for anyone on the panel? Any comments? Was there anyone else, again, who wants to testify on House Bill 4146A? Not seeing, we'll close the public hearing, open a work session on House Bill 4146A.
Excuse me. To move House Bill 4146A to the floor with due pass recommendation.
All right, Senator Cruz moves House Bill 4146A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any questions? Any discussion? Any objection?
Mr. Chair, I just want to thank the sponsors of the bill for moving it forward. I think it's an important bill, and really glad to see that this is before this body, this session.
All right. Any other comments? No objections. So ordered. And Senator Dinkfelder, would you be the carrier on this bill?
I would be honored to. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 4146A. Thank you very
much
for coming
over.
Now we're going to open up our last of the two bills that we have scheduled for today, public hearing on House Bill 4035. And
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4035 comes to you from the Oregon Law Commission. It ensures that a financing statement filed with the Secretary of State's office protects a secured party's interest in the personal property if the debtor's name that is on the financing statement is the same as the name of the debtor's most recent driver's license, or for business entities is the most recently one on file with the appropriate government business entity, usually the Secretary of State's office. Ensures that a financing statement filed in a state where the property is originally located is valid for 4 months after the property is moved to another state. Gives a four-month grace period for filing a new financing statement after business organizations merge.
All right, thank you. I have three people who have signed up at this point. Winnie Johnson, Professor Carl, is it Bier? Bier. And then Paul Cosmo. Why don't all three of you come on up together? Is there anyone else who will want to give testimony today on House Bill 4035? Sure, Wendy or Professor Bier, who's going to start us off?
Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, my name is Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director and General Counsel for the Law Commission. As counsel explained, this is a bill recommended by the Law Commission. We had a work group of debtor and creditor attorneys, consumer advocates, the Secretary of State's office, and the banking industry that worked on this bill. It comes from the Uniform Commission out of Chicago, which is for this particular area, the Uniform Commercial Code is done by the Uniform Commission and the ALI, the American Law Institute, because all 50 states do have the Uniform Commercial Code Article 9, which governs secure transactions. So all states will be adopting this update of the Uniform Commercial Code in this year. We need to get it ready for 2013 when all states will be implementing it. It came out of your out of the House 59-0, came out of the House Business and Labor Committee also unanimously. As counsel explained, it's an update. We did have two amendments that came in that were non-uniform amendments that came in at the request of Mr. Cosgrove. The committee accepted one of those as a friendly amendment and rejected the other. I just want to explain the materials you have before you. They look pretty thick, but there's a reason for that. We have a one-page summary, which is the Reader's Digest version, and then you have the committee's report. If you look on page 3, you'll see who participated in the work group. I just want to note that for the record that it was an open work group and it was a consensus product. And then at the very end of the report, there's a really thick document, and that's the official commentary for the UCC. It's important that we put it in legislative history because all states have this Uniform Commercial Code, and the commentary are accepted as the intent behind those updates. And so we want to make sure that it's in the record, should there be litigation, that we are indeed following the Uniform Act. So those are the materials. Professor Carl Bier at the University of Oregon was a reporter for this project. He teaches in this area and was a great asset to the committee. The Secretary of State's office also participated. As counsel mentioned, they're the ones who administer the UCC in Oregon, and they're in the room as well should you have questions, but it comes with their support as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Professor.
Thank you, Chair Pozanski, members of the committee. I am grateful for this opportunity. As Deputy Director Johnson mentioned, the bill concerns updates to Article 9 of the Uniform Commercial Code.
Professor, I need you to just put your name on the record.
Oh, excuse me. My name is Carl Bier, professor at the University of Oregon School of Law.
Thank you.
Article 9 of the Uniform Commercial Code governs personal property secured lending, which is best thought of as analogous to loans secured by mortgages on real estate. The difference is that it's a mortgage, if you want, we call it a security interest, on property other than real estate. So important kinds of property that it concerns is inventory, equipment of a business, accounts receivable of business, property of individuals as well if they're taking out a secured loan. And it's a framework to assure lenders and borrowers that they understand the consequences of the transaction. The statute that's currently on the books was adopted by Oregon and all 50 states about a dozen years ago. And in the time since then, there have been some practical problems that have emerged that the sponsors of the bill are addressing with HB 4035 and its counterparts across the country. The centerpiece of Article 9 is what we call the filing system. for financing statements. A financing statement is intended to be a simple one-page form. It's filed as a matter of public record with the Secretary of State's office. It's roughly analogous to the recording of a mortgage, and it sets out the name of the borrower, the name of the secured party, and a description of the collateral. The function of the financing statement is to be public notice to the world, especially to prospective lenders, so that before anybody chooses to extend a loan to a certain borrower, they can check the records and make sure whether the property that they're thinking about taking as collateral is already encumbered or not. And that'll inform their decision on whether to lend at all or what type of interest rate to demand, so on. Now, the debtor's name, that is to say the name of the borrower, is the linchpin of the system. It's the way the Secretary of State's office indexes the financing statements. It's the way that prospective lenders would look into the system to see whether there's a prior filing that affects their prospective transaction or not. And there's been some important uncertainty about the name of the borrower, particularly when the borrower is an individual. The basic idea is that there is no uniform law of names in this country. People can and do have different names on different documents, birth certificates, driver's license, social security cards, and quite apart from tax returns, I might mention, and quite apart from any documentation at all, there are names under which parties conduct business and are known by. And the current statute offers very little guidance on what version of an individual's name to use in the financing statement. That this down the line creates problems for people having confidence whether they've found prior filings or not. So the what HB 35 would do is to assure filers of financing statements that they have correctly carried out the public filing. If the name takes one of three forms, the name on the most recent driver's license of the debtor, or the last name and first given name of the borrower, or in retention of current law, a more open-ended standard, the individual name of the debtor, the name of the debtor, which is currently the only guidance the statute gives. So what the bill adds, in effect, to current law is to create a safe harbor, that is, give confidence to filers that if they follow one of the more definite prongs of the statute, that is to say the driver's license or the last name and first given name, that they can be assured that they've complied with the system correctly. At the same time, retention of current law, referring more broadly to the individual name of the debtor, gives flexibility to others outside the safe harbor, if you want to use that metaphor. The idea being that the Article 9 system is used very broadly across the spectrum of transactions by professional lenders, but also non-professional or one-time lenders who might not otherwise. They might not have the foreknowledge to comply with the technicalities of just the safe harbors. So we think it's a good accommodation of certainty for those that can manage the exact rules and flexibility for those who might not be able to. That's the first main topic of the bill. More briefly on two other topics of the bill. The debtor's name for organizational debtors, what we call registered organizations. And these are corporations, LLCs, limited partnerships, entities of that nature that are created by a filing with the Secretary of State's office. We need to have clarity on the name of these entities when they are debtors giving security interests in their personal property. And the bill clarifies what's been the intent for the past dozen years, but hasn't been well expressed in the statute. It clarifies that the name is what the parties forming the organization have declared to be the name on the so-called public organic record that they file with the Secretary of State's office. The last item, on the summary, the bullet point is called reliability of collateral when the debtor's location changes. Debtors are located in one jurisdiction or another depending on where they reside, if they're an individual, where their office is, if they're a certain kinds of organization, where they're incorporated, if they're artificial state-created entities. And their location can change. For example, an individual can move from, to take one example, Washington to Oregon. When the debtor moves, the state in which the lender files its public notice is supposed to change. So that if a loan is extended while an individual debtor lives in Washington and is still outstanding when the debtor moves to Oregon, the onus falls on the secured creditor to follow that development and give credit, public notice to prospective creditors in Oregon by filing in that state. The question is, how soon does that have to be done? We want to balance the interests of public notice to new creditors against undue burdens to existing creditors to monitor their debtors every day. How often does that? How soon does it have to be done? And is there protection to what we call turnover collateral in the meantime? I'm referring especially to inventory and accounts receivable. What the bill does is extend what's currently a safe harbor of 4 months. Following the date of the move. Essentially, Oregon statute currently provides that a financing statement filed in, say, Washington continues to be effective after the debtor's move to Oregon up to 4 months. And within that time, the creditor is expected to make a new filing in Oregon. That's current law, but it doesn't currently extend to this turnover collateral that I've mentioned, which can be the lifeblood of a business. It can be the primary source of security to the lender in being assured that the loan would be repaid. In the report, I give the example of jewelry of a debtor that could, all the existing jewelry might be sold and replaced by new jewelry. The deal between the parties is that that newly acquired jewelry should be part of the collateral for the loan. But there's currently no protection during the four-month grace period for that new inventory. So the bill corrects that oversight. Those are the major topics. I'll stop there and be happy to take questions.
All right, thank you. We'll take other testimony. Paul, why don't you go ahead and give us yours, and then we'll open up for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul Kosk, representing the Oregon Bankers Independent Community Banks of Oregon and the John Deere Financial Company. Ms. Johnson mentioned there were two amendments offered on the House side. One had to do with the definition of farm and forestry equipment and how you perfect security interests. That's been accepted. It's not been controversial, and it's part of the bill in front of you. The one that was not accepted has to do with something that the Uniform Commissioners, Commissioners of Uniform State Laws did for the first time in my recollection when they proposed a UCC amendment to all the states. Instead of proposing a uniform act, they proposed a uniform act with Alternative A and Alternative B. And each state is having to choose between Alternative A and Alternative B. And there's a difference of opinion about which is better. It has to do with that thing that the professor just mentioned. What is the person's name? The professor mentioned current law, there's no guidance at all about what name to use on the filing. And obviously, in a filing system, the whole point of it is you need to know where to put it and you need to know where it is to get it back. So not having any guidance on what name to use for someone is a problem in the current law. Alternative B, selected by the commission, has the three different options the professor mentioned. Alternative A says, and it's preferred by most, if not all, lenders, if the person has a current valid driver's license or state-issued ID card, that's the name you use. In those cases where the person doesn't have one of those, then you can use one of the other alternatives. From our perspective, it gives more certainty to the filing system. And I've had discussions with the chair, and I think that at the moment, states are differing on which way to go. Last time I had a count from Ms. Johnson, 8 states had picked A, and 4, which is use the driver's license name. And 4 had picked B. If we pick B, as the bill is before you, it'll make it 8-5. As she mentioned, all 50 states will be making this selection either this year or next year, because we all hope these changes are implemented together, all 50 states together, on July 1st, 2013. I would hope that if, in fact, those states, it shows in the next year that more states are picking A than B, that we will then be willing to reconsider this issue, reconsider the commission's recommendation to go with B, and in fact, if the majority of states are going with A, that we would in fact relook at this issue in next session. Because I think
majority, but
The purpose of a Uniform Act is to be uniform. If most states are picking A, we ought to be going in that direction. So that would be the request that we would have, is that we leave this door slightly ajar for another examination in 2013 on this issue of alternative A or B. We always think of a Uniform Act as being uniform. This is the one case where it hasn't been uniform. I just wish the commissioners had made a choice when they had the issue in front of them back in D.C., but they left it to each of us to make that choice. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right, I'm going to open up for questions, but before I do, I want to put one thing on the record. It's already been made reference in one of the speakers regarding the, I want to call it, it's the UCC Article 9 work group, which is the larger document that we have. This is going to be incorporated with being part of our record here today. Want that on the record, that it is part of our record for going forward. If there are any issues that we as the legislature are in fact embracing and incorporating into our record, the Oregon Law Commission's work group project that was headed by the professor and looks like in a few others. It's dated January 25th, 2012. And I'll ask the first question. Professor, you talked about 4 months. I glanced at the summary sheet, and it says 4 months. How do we calculate 4 months? Are we saying every month has 30 days, or how's that going to be factored in?
Chairman Przanski, members of the committee, it's an interesting question that often presents itself when we talk about time limits in statutes, particularly longer time periods when we're talking about, you know, rather than three business days, say, which is very precise and can define exactly what a business day is. When you start talking about longer periods like a year or 4 months here, the usual approach is to avoid technicalities like the number of days in a month. It's just an unworkably micro level.
Okay.
And I don't believe there's explicit guidance in the statute on this, but the discussions I've heard always make reference to if the move is on the 1st of, say, January, then the 4 months would be the 1st of what? February, March, April? Right, the first of the corresponding.
Depending on which year it is, leap year or not.
Right, that kind of thing would fall out of the calculus as well, right?
Okay. All righty. Senator Wissett, and then back over on Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cosgrove points out that the folks that he represents generally support the choice A, and yet you recommend the choice B, and apparently have opposed adopting the choice A amendment. So would you explain why you chose B over A and why you would oppose A?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Winstead, thank you. I'd be glad to briefly address some of the thinking of the Oregon Law Commission work group on this. There are the two alternatives are both made available to states in the so-called Uniform Act. It's not the first time. It tends to be a somewhat unusual occurrence that the National Uniform Laws Group offers two alternatives. It's still considered to be a uniform act, even though it's fully contemplated that each state is free to choose one or the other of the alternatives. The effect is still that states are constrained from completely making up their own course through the snow. Parties transacting business across the states can be confident that the rule is either one or the other. So to some extent, they have equal dignity. Now, in the reasoning between the two, what it really comes down to is what we call the safe harbor approach, and that's what HB 4035 presents. That is to say, there is confidence to filers. They're assured that their financing statement will be effective if they follow one of the precise alternatives, combined with flexibility to non-expert filers through the preservation of existing law. That's the safe harbor approach. The contrary approach is what's sometimes called the only-if approach. A financing statement is effective only if it follows the most recently issued driver's license. It offers the same certainty to filers, but without the flexibility to those who might not know the technicalities of the rule. And the overall concern is that the most recently issued driver's license is not always an intuitively correct source to use for non-professional lenders who, after all, would have a lot of a lot riding on the correct filing of the document. It's what protects their right to the collateral and, you know, is their real grounding for being paid. If they know the debtor by a certain name, and it's likely that there would have been a relationship between the non-professional lender and the debtor, they're not strangers coming together just for this transaction. If the debtor is known, we could take the example from my report, by one version of a name, and the name on the driver's license happens to be a different version of the name. The concern is that the lender would not intuitively follow the name on the driver's license. You're looking at page 5 of the Oregon Law Commission report. There's one case that was litigated up at the top of the page. The debtor's full legal name was Richard Morgan Stewart IV. Well, his credit application was signed in the name Richard M. Stewart. The agreement granting the security interest was signed Rick Stewart. The paperwork regarding the financing statement was filled out as Richard Stewart. There are wider variations that are possible, too. In particular, there could be cases where the debtor's name is changed, but the driver's license has not been updated. A common situation, for example, is in a case of married women who adopt their husband's name, but retain their maiden name on their driver's license, which they're perfectly permitted to do. If they're known in their business under the married name, it would be surprising and counterintuitive, and the work group thought overly technical to insist on a filing under the name on the driver's license. So overall, there's a balance between exactitude in the filing system. Assurances to the filer, and assurances to later searchers, the later prospective searchers, the later prospective lenders that I mentioned who might be trying to find prior filings. And there's inherently a trade-off between how exacting do we make the filing, or do we allow some flexibility, and how easy do we make it to find for others to later find those filings. And that's really what that's the basic difference. It's a different viewpoint on where you come down on that conflict between filing and searching. The work group believed, and I won't. I apologize for the length of the answer. The work group believed that trade-off works out more favorably to alternative B. And I would, with your permission, I'd refer the committee to page 8 of the work group report, especially footnote 14. That details some of the reasons why we think a stricter filing rule doesn't really yield the benefits that you might think of for later searchers.
Yes.
Mr. Cosgrove, briefly, could you explain the other alternative, the other equal and opposite alternative?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt. I think, well, first of all, the update makes it very, very clear with business organizations there is only one precise filing that works. What our position is, we ought to try to attempt to get to that same degree of certainty when it's an individual. And although we do not have a national ID card in this country and maybe we don't want one, the closest thing we have for most of us is a driver's license. It's what allows us as to board airlines. It's what we have to show to cash a check. It's the kind of ID that most people think of as valid ID. And that if we are going to have one system that has some more certainty than the current system, the best way to use for ID is the driver's license that most of us carry. If we have one, if it's still current, if it's still issued by the state in which you're residing and it hasn't expired, that is the name we use. It's the name also that in some loan transactions people are asked to notarize documents, and it's the ID form that would likely be asked for by a notary. notary, and it's the ID form that most of us have most conveniently available. It's sort of a question of, you know, in a library, you either use the Library of Congress or the ISBN number, or maybe you can do it by title or name. If you allow all of those, you're going to have a kind of a more confused library than if you have a system that you use.
Thank you.
Senator Dinkfelder.
Thank you. I asked whose amendments was added to the original bill, the 4035. Is that yours, Mr. Cogburn?
Yes.
Could you explain to me this amendment? And then I in particular, had a question about the lawn and grounds care. A little bit of a concern about how many trucks that's going to involve that won't be. My understanding, let's see, it's under Section 21. So anyway, if you can explain the amendment, what the purpose is, that would be helpful.
Be happy to do so, Mr. Chairman, Senator Dinkfelder. The concern is, and we worked with DMV on this issue, and I think they're satisfied with the result. The concern is we have a very broad definition of what a vehicle is in Oregon, pretty much anything can go on the highway, yet clearly DMV doesn't want to title certain kinds of vehicles that are primarily not used on highway, and in fact, they're not designed for highway use. Classic example might be a farm combine. It can go on a highway. It will go on a highway between fields, but it's not highway street legal. It's not highway safe. The series of definitions in the existing statute caught much of that, but not quite all of it. The lawn and garden care we're talking about equipment is stuff that is not designed for highway use. So it won't include pickup trucks. They'll still have to have titles. It's the other things, literally riding tractors, that DMV doesn't generally title now anyway, will now be clearly defined as not having a title. And the reason why that's important is in order to perfect a security interest in it, in piece of property, if it has a title, you note it on the title. If it doesn't, you file a UCC financing statement. So we just need to have a clearer line than we had in Oregon between which way those go. Does that answer your question? Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair, members of the committee, to follow up Mr. Cosgrove's question, my assumption is that if it's a motor vehicle, the title is with DMV. Is that correct?
Yeah.
So if it's a car like my car, the title is with DMV. If it's a lawnmower, a riding lawnmower, the title, the notation or the financing statement would be with the Secretary of State's office. Now, my other assumption is that when it's an individual, most of these purchases are purchase money agreements, a consumer purchase, when it's an individual. My assumption is with business equipment, it's usually going to be a business entity that's buying the equipment. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Taylor, most times where you as an individual go buy a riding lawnmaker, you're not going to have a security interest in all. Those are generally done on open-end credit. So, in fact, it is likely almost always to be a business transaction where a groundskeeper for one or more golf courses buys a bunch of these and finances it. And then you are correct, since it is not a motor vehicle like a car or a truck, which has a title, it'll be perfected by notation on the UCC financing statement.
Professor, if I could ask you this question. When we talk about something moving, like, are we talking the debtor moving? I'm looking at the summary of 4035, the last notation. It says when debtor location changes, and then below we talk about when the business moves out of state. So what's moving? Is it the debtor, or is it the equipment that's moving?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Taylor, thank you very much for the question. The Article 9 system is keyed off of the location of the debtor.
The debtor.
Yes.
Okay.
So that theoretically property, no matter where located, is perfected by a filing at the location of the debtor.
So if someone lives in Vancouver and they have perfected interest, they buy property and there's a security interest, and that person moves to Portland, then the secured party would have to file in Oregon.
That's correct.
Thank you.
All right. Senator Courtney, any questions?
Well, I actually do, but I don't want to ask him until you're done.
Okay. All right. Any other questions or comments? With that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4035, I believe it was. Open a work session on House Bill 4035. Open it up for discussion. One thing I do want to put on the record, Mr. Cosgrove and I did meet prior to this hearing. I did tell him that I was comfortable with moving with the bill as it was written because we have had the Oregon Law Commission, which is, I think, a vital
arm of the legislature go through this process. I've also stated, and I've have gotten word back from the chair of the law commission, that we do not want to be a state on its own. And if we find out that we are one in the more minority, that we should be looking at this and decide on what, if anything, should be done during the 2013 session. But at this point, Chair is comfortable with what we have before us based on the certified smart people who are part of the commission. And Professor, thank you for your time, your effort. I understand from being a member of the commission how much time we let's say we embark on entities and individuals to make sure our process works. So
thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
All right, Senator Courtney.
Why don't you finish your business? Just before you shut down, I do have to ask you, but I don't want to.
Any motions for us?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4035A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right, Senator Cruz moves House Bill 4035 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. We're going to open it up for more discussions.
And just for the record, Mr. Chair, when I drive my combine on the road, I am legal.
Declare a potential conflict of interest.
No, I'm going to take a loan out on that. We're fine.
All right. Any other discussions? Any objections to the motion that's before us? Not seeing any. So ordered. And Senator Courtney, would you like to make any statements or ask any questions now that we've passed the bill?
I want to be very sure. It has come to my attention the last hour. A certain person suggested I carry this bill. And could I ask the learned professor a question or two, Chair? Would you allow me to do that?
Yes, sir, I would.
Because I got a hankering to do this. Professor Carl Merritt, you're on a faculty at the University of Oregon Law School. Do you teach the UCC?
Yes, Senator, I have that pleasure.
Can you teach commercial paper there?
Commercial paper, more generally commercial law, yes.
So when you went to law school, that was your emphasis? I mean, your interest was that in law school?
As a matter of fact, I didn't have the good advice to take this subject in law school.
Well, okay, then that's not going to work. All I'm going to say is, you know, when I was in law school, I know you're going to be surprised to hear this. I went to law school, graduated. I remember the Oregon State Bar, did some practice. I did everything I could in law school to avoid the UCC and contracts until I was informed by the faculty at the Boston University Law School that I was not going to graduate until I took basic classes in UCC and contracts. I got the worst grade in my class in both subjects, and by one more point loss, I would have flunked both of them. So I just hope you're not going to have me carry this bill, because I will tell you, there's no way. I have had an emotional barrier lock in my life as a lawyer. So I just was going to respect you very much that you would teach this. I don't take that wrong, because everyone, at least listening to Q&A, they're obviously learned, they understand, and the chair is really learned. He's one of these commissioners on this Oregon Law Commission. I just have to say that. So if you're having an inclination, Chair, to have me carry the bill, the answer would be no, 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 no. I just had to ask that, because it's just a thing. I don't know.
If the answer had been different, would that have changed your position on carrying the bill?
If my what?
If the answer had been different.
Which answer?
From the professor.
I don't understand his answer, because as soon as I say UCC, I black out. So I don't even know. I just don't understand it. How can you? Do you really enjoy teaching?
I was going to say, I'll remind you, you're on the record.
Chairman Krasinski and Senator Courtney, I've actually done a lot of thinking about the point you make. It's a widely shared discomfort that a lot of law students and lawyers have with the subject. And I think that it's because it's sometimes taught by people that don't have practical experience in the area. And so that it comes out looking like a lot of abstract rules that don't make common sense. But once you think about how the transactions play through in the real world, Senator, there needs to be common sense for people borrowing and lending substantial sums and trying to assure their rights. And the statute's well written with a view to the reality. So if it were taught that way, maybe there would be less of the attitude that I completely understand on your part.
Senator Cruz?
Mr. Chair, we in the Senate consider ourselves to be somewhat of a family. And we try to help each other. And when we have a member who has an emotional blockage, I think it's incumbent upon us to try to help that member overcome that emotional blockage.
Yes.
And I understand the fear that comes with that blockage, but the best way to deal with that fear is just to confront it openly.
You do not want to do this.
That hits close to the heart. As a family, I kind of really do appreciate that. The other thing I was wondering is, Professor, your course is taught every quarter or semester?
It's taught every semester, yes.
All right. And do you have room for someone to maybe audit the class?
There's a chair in the front row, Senator.
Excellent. Well, then, with that understanding, I think the chair will be wise to carry the bill himself, knowing that the other individual who was, I thought, volunteering the president. So, but I think we'll see if we can't get the good senator to come down for an audit of the class.
Well, Mr. Chair, to help him overcome this emotional barrier, I think we should really try to see.
It'd be kind of like a 10-step, 12-step program.
Yeah.
All right. With that, thank you very much. Is there anything else that we need to do for the order? Okay. At this point, Pam, correct me if I'm wrong, we have no other bills that are currently scheduled. We are waiting to see whether or not we do receive any more bills. Please keep notice. We have 1 hour notice. We'll know prior to, I guess, our last official meeting could be on Wednesday. Before we would be shutting down. I think the date is Thursday, which is not our regular meeting day. So with that, I want to thank everyone first for being here today, as well as working on the committee through this process. If we do get any other bills assigned to us, we'll make certain all the members know when and, well, which bills they are, and expect that would be heard this coming Wednesday at 1 p.m. With that, we're adjourned.